7. He had probably been very busy that day on all sorts of errands, and probably with success, which was reflected in the self-satisfied expression of his face when, at 6 o'clock that evening, he turned up at Stavrogin's. But he was not at once admitted. Stavrogin had just locked himself in the study with Mavriky Nikolaevich. This news instantly made Pyotr Stepanovich anxious. He seated himself close to the study door to wait for the visitor to go away. He could hear conversation, but could not catch the words. The visit did not last long. Soon he heard a noise, the sound of an extremely loud and abrupt voice. Then the door opened, and Mavriky Nikolaevich came out with a very pale face. He did not notice Pyotr Stepanovich and quickly passed by. Pyotr Stepanovich instantly ran into the study. I cannot omit a detailed account of the very brief interview that had taken place between the two rivals, an interview which might well have seemed impossible under the circumstances, but which had yet taken place. This is how it had come about. Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch had been enjoying an after-dinner nap on the couch in his study when Alexei Yegorych had announced the unexpected visitor. Hearing the name, he had positively leapt up, unwilling to believe it. But soon a smile gleamed on his lips, a smile of haughty triumph and, at the same time, of a blank, incredulous wonder. The visitor, Mavriky Nikolaevich, seemed struck by the expression of that smile as he came in. Anyway, he stood still in the middle of the room as though uncertain whether to come further in or to turn back. Stavrogin succeeded at once in transforming the expression of his face, and, with an air of grave surprise, took a step towards him. The visitor did not take his outstretched hand, but awkwardly moved a chair, and, not uttering a word, sat down without waiting for his host to do so. Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch sat down on the sofa, facing him obliquely, and, looking at Mavriky Nikolaevich, waited in silence. "If you can, marry Lizaveta Nikolaevna," Mavriky Nikolaevich brought out suddenly at last. And what was most curious, it was impossible to tell from his tone whether it was an entreaty, a recommendation, a surrender, or a command. Stavrogin still remained silent, but the visitor had evidently said all he had come to say, and gazed at him persistently, waiting for an answer. "If I am not mistaken, but it's quite certain, Lizaveta Nikolaevna is already betrothed to you," Stavrogin said at last. "Promised and betrothed," Mavriky Nikolaevich assented firmly and clearly. "You have quarrelled?" "Excuse me, Mavriky Nikolaevich." "No, she loves and respects me. Those are her words. Her words are more precious than anything." "Of that there can be no doubt. But let me tell you, if she was standing in the church at her wedding and you were to call her, she'd give up me and everyone and go to you."
"From the wedding?"
"Yes, and after the wedding."
"Aren't you making a mistake?"
"No. Under her persistent, sincere, and intense hatred for you, love is flashing out at every moment, and madness. The sincerest, infinite love and madness. On the contrary, behind the love she feels for me, which is sincere too, every moment there are flashes of hatred, the most intense hatred. I could never have fancied all these transitions before.
But I wonder, though, how could you come here and dispose of the hand of Lizaveta Nikolaevna? Have you the right to do so? Has she authorized you?"
Mavriky Nikolaevich frowned, and for a minute he looked down.
"That's all words on your part," he brought out suddenly. "Words of revenge and triumph. I am sure you can read between the lines. And is this the time for petty vanity? Haven't you satisfaction enough? Must I really dot my I's and go into it all? Very well. I will dot my I's if you are so anxious for my humiliation. I have no right. It's impossible for me to be authorized. Lizaveta Nikolaevna knows nothing about it, and her betrothed has finally lost his senses and is only fit for a madhouse, and, to crown everything, has come to tell you so himself. You are the only man in the world who can make her happy, and I am the one to make her unhappy. You are trying to get her, you are pursuing her, but I don't know why you won't marry her. If it's because of a lover's quarrel abroad and I must be sacrificed to end it, sacrifice me. She is too unhappy, and I can't endure it. My words are not a sanction, not a prescription, and so it's no slur on your pride. If you care to take my place at the altar, you can do it without any sanction from me, and there is no ground for me to come to you with a mad proposal, especially as our marriage is utterly impossible after the step I am taking now. I cannot lead her to the altar, feeling myself an abject wretch. What I am doing here, and my handing her over to you, perhaps her bitterest foe, is to my mind something so abject that I shall never get over it. Will you shoot yourself on our wedding day? No, much later. Why stain her bridal dress with my blood? Perhaps I shall not shoot myself at all, either now or later. I suppose you want to comfort me by saying that. You? What would the blood of one more mean to you? He turned pale, and his eyes gleamed. A minute of silence followed. "Excuse me for the questions I've asked you," Stavrogin began again. "Some of them I had no business to ask you, but one of them I think I have every right to put to you. Tell me, what facts have led you to form a conclusion as to my feelings for Lizaveta Nikolaevna? I mean, to a conviction of a degree of feeling on my part as would justify your coming here, and risking such a proposal." "What?" Mavriky Nikolaevich positively started. "Haven't you been trying to win her? Aren't you trying to win her? And don't you want to win her?" "Generally speaking, I can't speak of my feeling for this woman or that to a third person, or to anyone except the woman herself. You must excuse it, it's a constitutional peculiarity. But to make up for it, I'll tell you the truth about everything else. I am married, and it's impossible for me either to marry or to try to win anyone." Mavriky Nikolaevich was so astounded that he started back in his chair, and for some time stared fixedly into Stavrogin's face. "Only fancy. I never thought of that," he muttered. "You said then, that morning, that you were not married, and so I believed you were not married." He turned terribly pale. Suddenly he brought his fist down on the table with all his might. "If after that confession you don't leave Lizaveta Nikolaevna alone, if you make her unhappy, I'll kill you with my stick like a dog in a ditch!" He jumped up and walked quickly out of the room. Pyotr Stepanovich, running in, found his host in a most unexpected frame of mind. "Ah, that's you!" Stavrogin laughed loudly. His laughter seemed to be provoked simply by the appearance of Pyotr Stepanovich as he ran in with such impulsive curiosity. "Were you listening at the door? Wait a bit. What have you come about? I promised you something, didn't I?" "Ah, bah, I remember. To meet our fellows. Let us go. I am delighted. You couldn't have thought of anything more appropriate." He snatched up his hat, and they both went at once out of the house. "Are you laughing beforehand at the prospect of seeing our fellows?" chirped gaily Pyotr Stepanovich, dodging round him with obsequious alacrity, at one moment trying to walk beside his companion on the narrow brick pavement, and at the next running right into the mud of the road, for Stavrogin walked in the middle of the pavement, without observing that he left no room for anyone else. "I'm not laughing at all," he answered loudly and gaily. "On the contrary, I am sure that you have the most serious set of people there. Surly dullards, as you once deigned to express it. Nothing is more amusing sometimes than a surly dullard." "Ah, you mean Mavriky Nikolaevich? I am convinced he came to give up his betrothed to you, eh? I egged him on to do it indirectly. Would you believe it? And if he doesn't give her up, we'll take her anyway, won't we, eh?" Pyotr Stepanovich knew, no doubt, that he was running some risk in venturing on such sallies, but when he was excited, he preferred to risk anything rather than to remain in uncertainty. Stavrogin only laughed. "You still reckon you'll help me?" he asked. "If you call me. But you know there's one way, and the best one."
"Do I know your way?"
"Oh, no, that's a secret for the time. Only remember, a secret has its price."
"I know what it costs," Stavrogin muttered to himself,
but he restrained himself and was silent. "What it costs? What did you say?" Pyotr Stepanovich was startled.
"I said, damn you and your secret! You'd better be telling me who will be there. I know that we are going to a name-day party, but who will be there?"
"Oh, all sorts. Even Kirillov."
"All members of circles?"
"Hang it all, you are in a hurry. There's not one circle formed yet."
"How did you manage to distribute so many manifestos, then?"
"Well, we are going only four members of the circle. The others on probation are spying on one another with jealous eagerness and bring reports to me. They are a trustworthy set. It's all material which we must organize, and then we must clear out. But you wrote the rules yourself. There's no need to explain."
"Are things going badly, then? Is there a hitch?"
"Going. Couldn't be better. It will amuse you. The first thing which has a tremendous effect is giving them titles. Nothing has more influence than a title. I invent ranks and duties on purpose. I have secretaries, secret spies, treasurers, presidents, registrars, then assistants. They like it awfully. It's taken capitally. Then the next force is sentimentalism, of course. You know, amongst us, socialism spreads principally through sentimentalism. But the trouble is these lieutenants who bite. Sometimes you put your foot in it. Then come the out-and-out rogues. Well, they're a good sort, if you like, and sometimes very useful, but they waste a lot of one's time. They want incessant looking after. And the most important force of all, the cement that holds everything together, is their being ashamed of having an opinion of their own. That is a force. And whose work is it, whose precious achievement is it, that not one idea of their own is left in their heads? They think originality a disgrace."
"If so, why do you take so much trouble?"
"Why, if people lie simply gaping at everyone, how can you resist annexing them? Can you seriously refuse to believe in the possibility of success? Yes, you have the faith, but one wants will. It's just with people like this that success is possible. I tell you, I could make them go through fire. One has only to din it into them that they are not advanced enough. The fools reproach me that I have taken in everyone here over the Central Committee in the innumerable branches. You once blamed me for it. But where's the deception? You and I are the Central Committee, and there will be as many branches as we like."
"And always the same sort of rabble.
Raw material. Even they will be of use."
"And are you still reckoning on me?"
"You were the chief. You were the head. I shall only be a subordinate, your secretary. We shall take to our bark, you know. The oars are of maple, the sails are of silk. At the helm sits a fair maiden, Lizaveta Nikolaevna." "Hang it! How does it go in the ballad?"
"He is stuck," laughed Stavrogin.
"No, I'd better give you my version. There you reckon on your fingers the forces that make up the circles. All that business of titles and sentimentalism is a very good cement, but there is something better. Persuade four members of the circle to do for a fifth on the pretense that he is a traitor, and you'll tie them all together with the blood they've shed, as though it were a knot. They'll be your slaves. They won't dare to rebel or call you to account."
"But you shall pay for those words," Pyotr Stepanovich thought to himself. "And this very evening, in fact, you go too far."
This, or something like this, must have been Pyotr Stepanovich's reflection. They were approaching Virginsky's house.
"You've represented me, no doubt, as a member from abroad, an inspector in connection with the Internationale," Stavrogin asked suddenly.
"No, not an inspector. You won't be an inspector. But you are one of the original members from abroad, who knows the most important secrets. That's your role. You were going to speak, of course.
What's put that idea into your head?
Now you are bound to speak."
Stavrogin positively stood still in the middle of the street in surprise, not far from a street lamp.
Pyotr Stepanovich faced his scrutiny calmly and defiantly. Stavrogin cursed and went on. "And are you going to speak?" he suddenly asked Pyotr Stepanovich. "No, I'm going to listen to you." "Damn you! You really are giving me an idea." "What idea?" Pyotr Stepanovich asked quickly. "Perhaps I will speak there, but afterwards I will give you a hiding, and a sound one too, you know. By the way, I told Karamazinov this morning that you said he ought to be thrashed, and not simply as a form, but to hurt, as they flog peasants. But I never said such a thing. No matter. Se non è vero. Well, thanks. I am truly obliged. And another thing. Do you know, Karamazinov says that the essence of our creed is the negation of honour, and that by the open advocacy of a right to be dishonourable, a Russian can be won over more easily than by anything. An excellent saying. Golden words, cried Stavrogin. He's hit the mark there. The right to dishonour. Why, they'd all flock to us for that. Not one would stay behind. And listen, Verhovinsky, you are not one of the higher police, are you? Anyone who has a question like that in his mind doesn't utter it. I understand, but we are by ourselves. No, so far I am not one of the higher police. Enough, here we are. Compose your features, Stavrogin. I always do mine when I go in. A gloomy expression, that's all, nothing more is wanted. It's a very simple business.